Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the end of the statewide mask mandate is approaching, but Salt Lake City says not so fast. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland visits Utah as part of a review of the state's downsized national monuments. And Weber County commissioners declare their county a Second Amendment sanctuary. Joining me for this conversation via Zoom today, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Leah Larson. And good morning, Leah. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for being here. Also, reporter Brian Maffley is with us. Good morning to you, Brian.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for having me again.
Thanks for being here. And editorial page editor George Pyle, thanks to you as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this discussion with your questions or comments. You can tweet to @KCPW. You can also call us. The number is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Well, guns, masks, and monuments. It's like we're in a John Huston film. I think I'm going to start with the story that's close to home, and that means that we will begin with the story of masks, the mask mandate. Leah Larson, that is coming to an end in the state of Utah tomorrow, Saturday, by legislative decree, but not here in Salt Lake City. Tell us why not.
Yeah, it has been an interesting week for local politics and masks. So by way of background, there was a quote-unquote endgame bill that the legislature passed this last session, which, as you said, lifts the mask mandate on Saturday unless a county government like a commissioner or council decides to extend it. So Salt Lake County opted not to do that on Wednesday, but pretty much moments after that, Aaron Mendenhall, the mayor of Salt Lake City, declared that that didn't apply to her local authority and her ability as a mayor to declare local emergencies. She issued a proclamation that included several emergency declarations she made in 2020 relating to the pandemic, but also the windstorm, also the earthquake. And she issued another one saying that the mask mandate would continue in the capital city. And we will see if that is challenged by the legislature. But that's where things are.
What was her rationale for doing that? I mean, the mayor obviously, I know she had a press conference on Wednesday morning, and that to some extent she's done this before, but she questioned the logic behind that so-called pandemic endgame bill. Can you talk about that? Why she decided to do this?
Yeah, like I said, she believes that that endgame bill does not apply to her local authority to declare emergencies. She also called, lifting the mask mandate kind of premature, arbitrary. It wasn't really based on public health data. It was just a date that lawmakers selected.
What exactly does Mayor Mendenhall's proclamation require of people who, you know, happen to be in her city, who reside in her city, or who happen to be in the city that she leads?
You know, I think it's kind of maintaining what has come to be the status quo. So masks in public spaces, when you're around people who aren't in your immediate household that you can't social distance from, you can remove it if you're actively eating. But just kind of the situation we've all become familiar with over the past year.
Yeah. You talked to the sponsor of the so-called pandemic endgame bill, and this is Clearfield Republican Representative Paul Ray. He's not a fan of the mayor's action. What did he have to say?
He doesn't believe she has the authority to do what she's doing. However, he kind of said he's not sure whether it's worth a legal challenge given the amount of time that would take. I think what's worth noting is that according to the endgame bill, even if a local government extends their mask mandate, once the state meets three sort of targets regarding caseloads, ICU bed use by COVID patients, and vaccines, the state acquiring a certain number of first dose vaccines, every pandemic measure goes away. And we already have met the caseload and ICU bed thresholds, and we're pretty close to the vaccines. So I suspect he thinks that, you know, all those measures are going to go away soon enough that it's not really worth mounting a legal challenge.
Just on the fact that Ray's bill, you know, it allows for county government bodies to require masks or to, you know, to keep these public health measures going. Another story that you reported this week, Leah, is that Salt Lake County said that it would not keep requiring masks. There's some disconnect there, I guess, between Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County. Why did the county, and this is, I think, the county council, make that decision? Or what did they say was their reason for doing that?
So the county council was waiting for a recommendation from the health department, the local health department. And Gary Edwards on Wednesday issued a letter recommending against an extended mask mandate. However, in this letter, he kind of issued a rebuke against state lawmakers, saying that they sort of created the situation where the, you know, state lawmakers are in a win-win situation and they're putting all the burden on counties, county governments, and county health departments to take all the, you know, the fallout if caseloads rise again, or if, you know, people start getting sick again, if the pandemic, if you see another surge. It's kind of all on the county's hands with this bill. So I don't know if you watch the county council meetings every week, you'll know that Gary Edwards, the health director, is kind of a mild mannered, sort of soft spoken guy, but he had a pretty strongly worded letter directed at state lawmakers.
Here back, you know, coming back to Salt Lake City, the mayor in her press conference on Wednesday pointed out some health metric disparities, including when it comes to vaccination rates. And I have a clip of that from her press conference at City Hall on Wednesday. Let's just take a quick listen and then I'll come back to you for some more information. Leah, we'll be right back. Let's take a listen.
By the state's own standards, every part of Salt Lake City is still in the high rate of case incidence or very high rate. The state has also only reached 56% of its goal for allocating prime doses of the vaccine so far. And here in Salt Lake City, only a quarter of the residents in Glendale and Rose Park have received at least one dose of the vaccine, compared to about 50% in the Avenues and the East Bench. That data, coupled with warnings from epidemiologists about the rapid spread of the highly contagious COVID variants, is enough to tell me that we need to keep doing what has worked, wearing masks.
And Leah, the mayor, you know, there doesn't talk about the, I mean, she's pointing out those disparities in vaccination rates between neighborhoods. She doesn't talk about the reasons for those disparities, but they are there. And I guess, Lee, I don't know if the mayor said this as explicitly, but the point she's trying to make is, you know, one that I think health officials have been trying to make for a long time, which is this isn't about, you know, individual freedom so much as it is about the safety of other people in your community. Is that a fair summary of what the mayor is trying to get across? I guess part of what I'm driving at also is that, you know, you have county health officials saying that the mask mandate can end. You have the city and the city council citing other public health officials saying, let's keep it going. And of course, these communities in Salt Lake City that don't have those vaccination rates are a part of Salt Lake County. It seems like there's some disconnect here. But maybe we'll start with the mayor's rationale. Is that accurate, you know, that that she just disagrees, I guess, with what the state is doing?
No, I think the mayor has a good point, because the thresholds that I mentioned in this endgame bill, they are arbitrary. The caseloads that they want to meet to lift all public health orders, that's a statewide number. And if you look zip code to zip code, like some zip codes are higher than others. The vaccine threshold that they want to reach, the state just has to obtain the vaccines. They don't even need to have been administered. I think, like I said, I think she has a point there.
You also got a quote from, you know, just from Utah House Speaker Brad Wilson on this, and he pointed to basically, you know, disregarding that neighborhood level data consideration, I guess. He pointed to the county as having made the right decision in his mind. What did he say?
That he doesn't think the city should place requirements that override basically state law. And that's his opinion.
Okay. Your story on this ends with Matt Caputo from Caputo's Market and Deli in Salt Lake City, who has been frustrated. He says he's been frustrated by that end game bill and the end of the mask mandate. And his frustrations have to do with the industry that he works in, the, you know, the food service industry. Can you explain that?
He had a pretty impassioned plea with the public to just, you know, be respectful of businesses who continue to require masks. He said that early on in the pandemic, when businesses in Salt Lake City were requiring masks, but the rest of the state wasn't, just how difficult it was for his frontline workers, how they would get yelled at and harassed by customers. And, you know, they're just looking to do the best to protect their own health as well as the safety of their other patrons. So he expressed worry that with the statewide mask mandate being lifted, but state lawmakers kind of giving this pass that, you know, local businesses, you know, they can impose their own mandates. He worries that the harassment is going to come back, the irate customers are going to come back. So he's just hoping that people will be respectful of his employees.
And I guess that it would be easier if there was a statewide, if the statewide mask mandate persisted, because then he could point to that when people tried to come in, despite his store policy, not wearing masks.
Right. He said once the state implemented, you know, a statewide mandate, that it was easier for him to point to that and sort of be like, you know, it's not us, it's the state. And people were a little bit more cooperative with that.
Yeah. George Pyle, editorial page editor and we should say opinion columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, rather than asking, you know, who's made the right decision here about masks. Let's do that, because you can address that as a columnist. Let's start there. Who's making the right decision here, George, in your opinion, when it comes to masks continuing or not continuing?
Well, I don't think there's any question but that Mayor Mendenhall has made the correct decision. She has to worry about her city. She is correctly worried about the neighborhoods on the west side, which have a higher proportion of low income and working class people, frontline workers, people who can't work by Zoom, who have to actually go to work and face people. And the idea that the state just pick these arbitrary things as a way of going, making the mask mandate and other regulations go away. It's just ridiculous what the state has done. They've completely turned their back on what they always talk about, the importance of local control and decisions best made at the closest level of government. They always use that when they're complaining about the federal government, but they never hesitate to step in and tell cities and counties what they can and cannot do. The idea that, I mean, all these benchmarks are statewide. They don't pay any attention to the fact that there are great variables between cities and counties. Now, they recognize that somewhat in giving counties some leeway, but Salt Lake County, now that the council is dominated by Republicans, made the wrong decision. They should have kept the mandate in place. There's some question as to the legal authority of the city to do this. The city does have, under its own laws, the power to declare emergencies, and that's what Mayor Mendenhall is using for this declaration. And as you mentioned, one of the reasons for doing such a thing is to back up businesses that actually care about their employees and their customers. And it does become easier, you would hope, when some customer insists on not wearing a mask in a business, even though that customer is, by not wearing a mask in a business, demonstrating that you shouldn't care what they think because they don't understand. But if you can say, look, it's a city regulation, I mean, maybe it made more sense when it carried more weight when it was a state regulation. But the mayor has done the right thing. And the idea that, you know, I mean, the state called it like its end game. Okay, it's not a game. It's this potentially deadly pandemic that we're dealing with here. And the legislature is trying to pretend that they can just pass a resolution and the hazard goes away. And I'm sorry, they're not that powerful.
George, Well, I'll come back to Leah in a minute on the question of whether or not the state called it the end game bill. I mean, we may have in the press given it that name in the end, but effectively that's what it does, is try to legislate away, public health measures pertaining to the pandemic, whether, on a certain date. But the question that I kind of wanted to ask you, George, is, has the quote unquote debate over wearing masks been a kind of stand in for something else that's happening in our country, in our city, in our community, part of, the ongoing culture wars in America, if you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's become part of that. And it's kind of sad, but you have people, including Sean Reyes, the attorney general, who went to these anti-mask rallies. It's just absurd. They've decided that the lives of their fellow citizens are less important than owning the libs, and that they can somehow proclaim themselves and other people immune to a pandemic that has claimed so many lives all around the world. And they seem, when you say I can assess my own risk and I can decide for myself whether I need to wear a mask or whether I need to get the vaccination, that is empirically false, because you don't wear a mask to protect yourself. You wear a mask to protect other people. And somehow we've got to the point where we think that protecting other people is bad, is cowardly, is wussy somehow, and real men don't protect other people; they just protect themselves. Now, where did that come from? Well, it is part of the culture wars. It is part of Trumpism. It is part of a Republican mandate now that we don't want to have a pandemic, so we're going to pretend we're not. Sure. Well, the coronavirus doesn't care what you think.
Again, George Pyle is an opinion columnist with the Tribune and editorial page editor. And George, I think that the parallel that often gets made, we'll head back to Leah Larson here in a minute and then go to our first break in the show. But, early on in the pandemic, the idea of wearing masks or not wearing masks was sort of drawn as a parallel to the discussion that was had over wearing seatbelts or not wearing seatbelts. When that conversation was happening, not all that long ago, actually, though, to be fair, seatbelts were never going to be temporary. And then, as you point out, seatbelts are about protecting the individual person as opposed to about community health. Is that the wrong analogy? Seatbelts and masks, it's a question that I actually tried to pose to former Governor Gary Herbert early on in the pandemic. Is it the wrong analogy, I guess?
Well, I wouldn't say it's wrong. You're right. It is. You wear a seatbelt to protect yourself. There's, I suppose, the rare occasion where an unbuckled person in a car sort of becomes a projectile, which makes an accident more dangerous to other people. Even people who might have been wearing a seatbelt. But part of the seatbelt thing is that highway patrol officers got a little tired of picking up dead bodies. And when they saw a way that they might have to do that a little less often, they started being in favor of it. Although, like so many things in America, is probably the insurance companies that actually made that decision, which is that seatbelts and airbags protect lives, and from the insurance company's point of view, save money.
Leah Larson, let's go back to you just before we head to a break. And first off, I'll ask you if there's anything huge from the story that we missed. But also, I can't remember if we got to this point, which is, when, from Salt Lake City's perspective, at what point in time will it be safe to say that masks aren't required in public spaces the way that they are now?
I think the mayor would probably say when we reach, herd immunity, when there's enough people vaccinated or have natural immunity, that we don't need them anymore.
Great. And, you know, there's other parts of this story. I mean, the University of Utah is going to continue to require masks on campus. I know that's not a story that you reported on, but I guess, you know, a debate that continues even when we know, though, that masks help prevent the spread of the virus. I guess that's just something to put out there very clearly.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. Sean Means had, a list of places that are still requiring masks. Jazz games, Real Salt Lake, the Bees, all the universities, all the schools, all Intermountain healthcare facilities, all state government offices and properties, including liquor stores.
I would add to that, all Salt Lake County buildings. Mayor Jenny Wilson obviously wanted to keep the mask mandate, but it was the county council had to make that decision.
Right.
But county facilities are under her portfolio, so she requires them there too.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, if a place doesn't require masks, you shouldn't go in it.
All right. That's George Pyle, editorial page editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. We've also been hearing from Leah Larson, who's a government reporter with that newspaper. We need to head to our first break in the show. Thanks to you both, by the way. When we come back, we will turn to the visit to the state of Utah by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Spanish language programming on Utah Public Radio is supported by our members and the USU Office of Global Engagement, fostering diversity, inclusion, and cultural awareness by supporting international students and scholars and facilitating study abroad opportunities. Information at globalengagement.usu.edu.
A new baseball season is here. But for minor league players, it's not all about home runs and glory.
Ready, set, throw!
Why there's no cheering on payday, on the next Reveal.
Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson and Brian Maffley, and by editorial page editor George Pyle. Leah and Brian are both reporters with the paper. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweet to @KCPW. Brian Maffley, you are public lands reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, and the story we are going to turn to now is all about public lands, national monuments. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, as promised, is here in Utah. Maybe just tell us what she's been doing over the past couple of days and remind us of the purpose of her visit to the Beehive State.
Yeah, sure, Roger. Deb Haaland has come to Utah to review what to do with Utah's two big national monuments, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. It's the third time Utah has hosted a interior secretary to kind of explore this question about the Bears Ears. And so she has been in San Juan County the last few days, touring parts of the monument and visiting with Governor Cox, and members of the Utah delegation, members of the Navajo tribe and other tribes that had proposed the Bears Ears Monument, and county commissioners, a lot of different people. And now today she was planning to be in Kane County to visit the Grand Staircase.
Right.
And again, local quote unquote stakeholders. So of course, these are the two monuments that, you know, then President Trump drastically reduced in 2017, not long, you know, a year into taking office. And it's part of the so-called ping pong effect of Utah's national monuments. They get designated, they get undesignated, And now President Biden is looking to restore these monuments to perhaps their original size. And in the case of Bears Ears, he might go much larger to what the Indian tribes had requested of Obama back in 2016.
Right.
They wanted nearly 2 million acres designated in Bears Ears, and Obama went with, you know, 1.3 million. And of course, Trump drastically reduced it into two discontinuous units. And you know, it seems like no one's ever been happy. We don't know where this monument is going to ever wind up. And so there's this time around, it looks like there's a push to kind of come up with some kind of permanent resolution to this. That's at least what Governor Cox would like to see.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's the question. Well, I have a question about the legal, you know, arguments that were playing out over the downsizing of the Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase, which, as you said, President Biden is, you know, it's generally thought that he's considering a restoration of those monuments, or at least a restoration of those monuments, as you said, and maybe something larger for Bears Ears. But there is the fact that there was this legal challenge to the shrinking of the monuments, and that never got resolved. What does that mean about the process that's happening now? Maybe you can remind us about those legal challenges.
Yeah, people, we seem to have forgotten about that. So five lawsuits were filed following Trump's reduction of the monument, challenging the legality of that order. You know, no president has ever, you know, slashed a monument to pieces like this using the Antiquities Act. That's the 1906 law that allows presidents to establish monuments. This is the first time that a president has ever cited that law to make the monuments much smaller. Now there's been a history of monuments getting adjusted. What happened in 2017 was not an adjustment to the monuments. It was a wholesale reduction. So those lawsuits were consolidated and are pending in federal court in DC. And, you know, should that judge make a ruling overruling with Trump's decision, you know, those monuments go back to where they were. And but I think what's happening now is those proceedings have been stayed to see what Biden does, which would supposedly render, you know, these lawsuits moot. But I really don't think they would be moot, because there's nothing. Let's say President Biden puts the monuments back the way they were. The next time a Republican gets elected to the White House, to the presidency, that person could put them back to what Trump did. So we have this kind of accordion-like effect with our monuments.
Right.
So a ruling from this judge and then getting an appellate review could at least, you know, make a call here. Can a president shrink monuments under the Antiquities Act?
There's a comment that we had emailed to us that's kind of vaguely on the same topic, and this is Tom from Vernal, who writes, "I googled Bears Ears and political football and came up with 2,390 hits. The term political football is a meme that the Republican Party is endlessly repeating in their attempt to gut the Antiquities Act. The person who made Bears Ears into a political football was President Trump when he untruthfully claimed the right to reduce the monuments created. That right is not in the Antiquities Act. This football game was started by the last Republican president and is being continued by the current GOP. No other previous monuments have ever been treated this way," says Tom from Vernal with his email comment to comments@kcpw.org. Thank you, Tom. Brian, this has been called, or this is being called, political football because of that. You called it accordion, the back and forth, the ping pong. Is the question unresolved, or was the question? I guess the question is, we don't know. We don't know whether or not the action by the former president was legal.
Yeah, that's a question that hasn't been settled and may not be settled, because Biden, everyone expects Biden to restore the monuments. It's the executive order he signed the first day of office, you know, talks about restoring the monuments, and he's ordered this review to be undertaken by his interior secretary to investigate the reduction of monuments and their current management conditions. And that's what Deb Haaland is up to now.
Okay.
She, under this executive order, she is to provide some recommendations to the president. Now, Tom Invernal is kind of spot on. The political football thing is a meme that emerged back in, shortly after Obama designated the Bears ears, and Trump comes to office, and they claimed, maybe George can weigh in here, but they absurdly claimed that by Trump shrinking the monuments, we're putting it into the football game. And it's like, no, dude, you're turning it into the football game. And so as we see, the game is continuing. Huh. And I would like to point out that the political leadership in Utah has completely changed more or less since Trump shrunk the monuments. We have a new governor with Spencer Cox. Mm-hmm. We have a Democratic Navajo majority pro monument on the San Juan County Commission.
Right.
And we have four of Utah's six members of Congress are new, starting with Mitt Romney, Senator Romney, who's taking a strong leadership position in this the monument discussion now.
He spoke
yesterday down in Blanding when they met with the reporters, speaking to the need to put an end to the fighting. And he's hoping to put together some legislation that everyone can go along with. Sure. To put an end to this. And I think everybody would agree that this back and forth isn't really serving anybody's purpose. I mean, think about it. We have a Bears Ears National Monument, but you really wouldn't know it if you went down to San Juan County. There's the only visitor center is run by a nonprofit group, Friends of Cedar Mesa. There's no signs up. There's no interpretive things, materials up there. If you you wouldn't really know there's a monument. In the meantime, it's getting overrun with visitation that's just going through the roof. And these are fragile places that need to be regulated. And now visitors have, the word is out. Cedar Mesa and Bears Ears is an amazing place, but it's not just the monument, it's the lands around the monument that got taken out. And I'm talking about Cedar Mesa mostly. Hundreds of thousands of people now visit these places, right. And it's and they're basically trashing the place.
Brian, you pointed out that so there's members of Utah's congressional delegation, several of them new, who are involved in this. Senator Mitt Romney, Representatives John Curtis and Blake Moore also met with Secretary Haaland here in Utah, I think yesterday or maybe the day before, as did Utah's Governor Spencer Cox. And they don't want to see the monuments restored to their original size, I imagine. That's been part of the state's stance this whole time, including all of the members of the congressional delegation, we're talking about both Bears Ears and Grand Staircase. I'm imagining that a casual listener or a casual news consumer might not know exactly, what we're talking about when we talk about all of this, what national monuments are and why state leaders are opposed to, these big national monuments. Can you lay that out, and then we'll get the opposite perspective on that as well. But why are they opposed?
Yeah, they believe that it's the federal government exerting even greater control over the public lands in our state, Utah. I should point out here that the first really big controversial designation was in Utah with the Grand Staircase Escalante in 1996 by Bill Clinton. I mean, there have been big designations historically. Theodore Roosevelt designated Grand Canyon, right, back in 1908. That was very controversial as well. But Clinton's action kind of set the stage for, you know, Utah's now notorious opposition to national monuments. The other Western states aren't like this. They have come to live with their big national monuments, the, you know, Missouri River Breaks in Montana, or these monuments in Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. Those states haven't, you know, pushed Nevada as well. They haven't pushed like Utah has against these monuments. They've more or less learned to live with them. But in Utah, we've pushed back, and they've become controversial. And so,
but I guess, Brian, why such opposition? Why? What is it about the lands in question, or is it the sort of philosophical idea of who gets to decide? What's the driving force behind the state of Utah's opposition to these monuments?
I would say that it's a philosophical opposition to increased federal control over our landscape. And the Antiquities Act seems to give, you know, Democratic presidents a really easy way to, appease their pro-conservation base by signing an executive order setting aside, you know, vast swaths of land. And the Antiquities Act does talk about, preserving the smallest amount of land possible to establish, to meet the goals of the monument. Well, at nearly 2 million acres, the Grand Staircase is pretty big, and the state's long argued that, that's not the minimum acreage needed to protect those resources. And well, that's been through the courts, and the courts have said, no, it's the right size.
Yeah. Right. And Brian, we're going to run low on time here pretty soon. And you know, you mentioned the fact that state leaders and our congressional delegation would rather see Congress act on this. And I guess that means defining the boundaries through Congress. But there are a variety of people now advocating for a bigger monument when it comes to Bears Ears than originally declared. That includes the president of the Navajo Nation and the tribes that were involved in that intertribal coalition. But since I asked you what state, why state leaders are opposed to the monuments, I should ask you for the arguments in favor of big monuments like this.
Yeah, well, Sally Jewell articulated this really well, is Obama's Interior Secretary, that landscape level designations are necessary because the resources they're protecting are the landscapes themselves. When the Antiquities Act was passed in 1906, I think the idea was these ancient Native American ruins and other sites like that are kind of small and defined. And now what we're seeing is, these resources are actually not small and defined. They're large swaths of habitat and scenic vistas and entire watersheds. And so the idea of protecting these lands now has kind of become a much bigger thing. And I think a lot of local political leaders are threatened by that. They think that the Antiquities Act now is being used to, push extractive industries off the landscape and keep people off these lands. I think a lot of people can understand that, but that's the goal of these designations isn't to keep people off of them. It's to make sure they're preserved for future generations. These lands are worth more intact than they are, mined and logged.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a kind of, speaking of philosophical questions, there's the, keeping people off the land as a way of preserving the land, there's maybe a public benefit there, but when people aren't there, they don't recognize the public benefit. It's a complicated question, and maybe I'll bring in opinion columnist George Pyle on that as well. And George Pyle, editorial page editor for the Tribune, Tom Invernal didn't like says that the term political football is a charged term, being used as a way to sort of discredit the Antiquities Act. What do you think about the process that's been happening over these past few years?
Well, for one thing I think maybe a lot of people don't don't really focus on. Every square inch of every national monument, with maybe there's some private inholdings, but it's already federal land. They don't go in there and take private land away from people. It already belongs to the United States of America, not to Utah. And so when you have people in Utah say that they're fiddling around with our land, it's not our land. It's the federal government's land, and they are responsible for taking care of it. And you can argue that they don't do a very good job, and you can argue that they don't always listen enough to the locals. Well, the federal government never listens enough to the locals, but it's still, it's their responsibility. I think the best thing for Biden to do would be to put the monuments back exactly the way they were before Trump came in, because he would be able to use the argument that the Antiquities Act doesn't allow for what Trump did. And so rather than come at it all new, we're just going to undo what Trump did. And any opportunity to undo anything that Trump did is an opportunity that must be seized. Especially in this case, I understand why the five tribes would like maybe to take this opportunity to make it bigger still. But I think Biden would be on better legal footing if he just said that the Trump action is legally and morally moot, and we put it back the way it was. And hopefully then we will get around to what should have been done. And I think probably Obama, thinking that he would be succeeded by Hillary Clinton, didn't worry so much about, is that now we need to get around to actually protecting the monument. We need park rangers. We need interpretive centers. We need people out there to police the territory so that you don't have people walking around picking up artifacts or defacing petroglyphs or something like that. That's what a monument should be, is something that actually protects the land. And because Trump and the Republicans weren't interested in that, it hasn't been done. It needs to be done. And putting the monuments back the way they were would help.
George, I'm going to actually bring Brian Mathley back into the conversation just for a moment here. Brian, you talked at the beginning of this conversation, you hinted at you told us that the common thinking here is that, you know, the monuments are going to be unshrunk. When do you expect that action to occur? And then, George is talking about management plans and protective measures put in place, how soon after the unshrinking might that happen? Give us a timeline.
Yeah, there really isn't one. Biden's executive order talks about, getting this report completed within 60 days. Well, that 60 days has come and gone. And I don't know if there is a time frame. And then once Holland submits her report, when does Biden act? We don't know. It's also important to note that we're not talking just about the size of the monument, but we're also talking about the quote unquote management conditions. And I think what we're going to see is a change in how who gets to have influence over management decisions. And we are going to see probably more tribal representation on these advisory committees for both monuments.
Brian, we need to head to a break, but I'll mention that your colleague, Zach Podmore, got a hold of a bunch of emails that showed the efforts that went into lobbying the Trump administration to slash these monuments, to slash their size. I'm assuming you've been following that. Can you give us a kind of short teaser on what's been uncovered through these emails so far before we head to a break?
Yeah. For the last couple of years, we have been trying to get these communications between who was then on the county commission, San Juan County Commission, and their lawyers and consultants they hired to fight the monument designation. And Zach, our reporter based in Bluff, kind of hit pay dirt when we finally got these documents, and they showed that they went to the county commission, went to extraordinary lengths to lobby the Trump administration to undo the monument. And they hired a number of lobbyists who apparently may or may not have been properly registered in disclosing their lobbying on the behalf of the county. And And it just, it all seemed like a big horrific waste of money since, it, you know, Trump was going to be reducing the monument anyway. And now it's about, and now it's all for naught because the monument's going to be put back. And that said, it's, you know, since that time, Phil Lyman has left the county commission. He, you know, the probably the most vocal anti-monument person, only to be replaced by one of the most pro-monument people, Willie Gray Eyes,
right?
A Navajo who's part of Utah Dene Bekea,
right?
And so now we have a pro-monument majority on the San Juan County Commission, and they have a resolution they've passed endorsing the $1.9 million.
Right. A larger monument, the monument that was originally being advocated for that didn't quite get that was. Yeah. Obama declared a smaller monument. That's what they're advocating for now. A change in local control. And now the local government is advocating for a bigger monument. Really interesting story. Check out Zach's reporting at sltrib.com. We needed to head to a break, but you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Brian Maffley and all the reporting that he's been doing on this. We'll be back in just a minute.
Next time on The Pulse,
STIR6=.
Researchers are finding out more about how kids learn.
What happens in the brain when we learn is there's change in the brain. Your brain creates new connections.
But how much of these findings are actually making it into schools?
Teaching reading is rocket science.
The role of research in education.
Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson, Brian Maffley, and George Pyle. It is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. Well, we at the beginning of the show, I teased masks, monuments, and guns. We got two out of the three done, and we are almost out of time. And so, Leah Larson, I'm wondering if you can just quickly tell us about the action that Weber County took on guns and what it does.
Yeah, so this week they declared the county a Second Amendment sanctuary, and not entirely sure what it does. The resolution says that it will prevent the county from using any public funds to do anything unconstitutional regarding the Second Amendment, but you know, the county can't do anything unconstitutional anyway. So,
right. It's just showing support, public support for guns in their county.
Yeah. Some political posturing, I would say.
Okay. I think that pretty much sums up that story, and I appreciate your telling us what happened up in Weber County. That's Leah Larson, government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Leah, why don't we start with you actually for the final segment of the show, which is the underplayed stories of the week, a chance to highlight something that maybe, you know, we didn't cover on the show that you want to draw listeners' attention to. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, so the Salt Lake County Republican Convention is tomorrow. And they will be electing new leadership. If you'll recall, their last chair stepped down amid allegations of harassment and bullying from several women.
Right.
So it will be interesting to see who they elect to take his place and whether that will set a new tone for the party.
And you point out in an article this week that that Kathleen Anderson jumped into this race and was
literally with minutes to spare.
Wow. And she had been surprised that there were no female candidates to become the next party chair. Check out Leah's reporting on this. Thanks. It's a great pick for underplayed story of the week. You can find it at sltrip.com. Let's turn to Brian Maffley. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Oh,
if you're ready.
Well, the Salt Lake. Yeah, I'm ready, dude. I this is something that's been on my mind now for a few years. This Salt Lake City School District has decided to start the high schools an hour later than they usually do. Moving the time back from 7:45 to 8:45, or possibly 9, which any parent of a high schooler will be grateful for. I know it'll reduce the conflict in my household, but a lot of studies have shown that teenagers need their sleep, and starting school before 8 a.m. is just a bad idea. So Salt Lake City is moving forward with a plan to start their three high schools an hour later than they have in the past.
Wow. That's a really interesting pick. Lots of people, I think, can understand the rationale behind it. I do wonder about people who have to get to work at like 8 in the morning. But All right. Well, thanks for that pick. And we'll turn to George Pyle for his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. George, I know you disagree with the title Underplayed.
It just doesn't apply to me so well, because if it's underplayed, I haven't seen it. But I am interested in this story Matt Canham has this morning about the Mike Lee, Rand Paul senators of the world are being, I don't want to say targeted, that sounds too hostile, but are a focus of a new effort to legalize marijuana nationally, or at least decriminalize it. And the idea is that you have liberals who have always been in favor of that, and libertarian-leaning conservatives who think might also be in favor of that. So something actually bipartisan may happen. And I think it would be almost as good an idea as starting school an hour later. I don't know why they couldn't have done that 40 years ago.
George Pyle, thank you for that pick for Underplayed Story. And it's an interesting one. Bipartisanship somewhere exists out there, and the universe isn't going to implode. My pick for Underplayed Story is Andy Larson's article about variants, the COVID variants, that is up on the Tribune's homepage right now. It breaks down those coronavirus variants and the vaccine effectiveness against them, and also, you know, where the variants can be found. It's just some more well-presented data from Andy Larson on the pandemic. That is my pick for Underplayed Stories, Story of the Week. You can find it and all of the stories that we have been covering at sltrib.com. And with that, I will say Leah Larson, Brian Maffley, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. That does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Join us live every Friday morning. You can also find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You might have noticed that we're running internet audio on the show this week and last, and that's thanks to someone who contributed to KCPW's charity wish list, allowing some new studio equipment to be purchased. So thanks very much for making that happen. This nonprofit outlet runs because of your support. You can do that at kcpw.org. Add your own. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next week.
Join us here on Utah Public Radio throughout the week for Utah State University Extension's Ask an Expert, featuring timely information from raising your own backyard chickens to keeping our waterways clean and tips promoting mental wellness at work. If you've missed the latest segment for the week, you can find all the Ask an Expert features on our website, upr.org, and on our UPR app.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.